Our main speaker for this evening, Leanne from San Diego.
Can you guys hear me? Okay. No, you can't? Can you hear me now? Okay. My name's Leanne, and I'm a real alcoholic. And I'm a real alcoholic as I fit the description in the first 52 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm really glad to be here tonight. I want to thank Damien for asking me to speak. And let's give a shout-out to the birthday people and the token takers tonight. I'm glad you're here. And I also want to give a shout-out to the Cardiff House and the Freedom Ranch and any other recovery home that's here tonight. Thank you for being here. Thank you. My sobriety date is November 9th, 2005. I have a couple home groups. I have a sponsor. She's sitting in the front row. Her name is Tyla, and I also sponsor. And the reason why I tell you that is because I want you to know that I am in that circle and triangle. I'm in the unity part. I bring my body to the meetings, recovery. I'm actually in the 12 steps right now. I'm actually taking a group through the work, and also I'm going through the steps myself, and my service commitment, the service side of that triangle, and I work with other alcoholics, other women in this program, so I stay pretty balanced. And whenever I'm feeling like I'm a little, you know, off kilter, my sponsor always asks me, so where are you in that triangle, that circle and triangle? It's like a three-legged stool. I got to make sure that I'm perfectly balanced in every area of that triangle. This meeting, this SoCal speaker meeting, has a very special place in my heart. And the reason why is because I'm going to get choked up. First of all, I think it's the best speaker meeting in Southern California. Your speaker getters do an amazing job getting great speakers, and I'm honored that they've asked me. I hope I can live up to that tonight. But 5 years ago in December, I heard a woman speak here that I had 4 years sober, and I was what we don't like to talk about in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was an untreated alcoholic, and I was dying inside from this spiritual malady and at a place where I was extremely depressed and suicidal. And I came to this meeting 5 years ago in December and heard this woman speak, and it has ever since changed my life. So this meeting means a lot to me because I found who is now my sponsor here tonight. She came tonight to hear me speak, and I find it ironic, too, because I, too, stalked her. It's like, by the way, what is this with the stalking? But thank you, Alex, for your 10-minute share. Alex is my brother from another mother, and we have the same home group, too, on Wednesday night in Old Town, and I love you, Alex. Thank you so much for your share. So I'm going to tell you about what my life was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And, you know, I was sitting in prayer and meditation a few weeks ago, and it came to me that really my life is like broken down into four chapters. So the best way to start off with is the first chapter of my life, and that was in the beginning. And my mother is from the Philippines, and my father was a Marine Corps pilot. And they met in the Philippines, and, you know, I'm half Filipino. My mom, who is not alcoholic, I think I've seen her drink on like maybe 10 occasions. She's one of those that goes, oh, I'm starting to feel it. I have to stop, you know. And I'm like, oh, why? That's when you got to get going, you know. And she's like, you know, seriously, like maybe 7 times I've seen my mom drink in the last 50 years. And my father, on the other hand, is questionable. That's where I believe that I inherited my alcoholism from. But my father divorced my mother and my family when I was 2.5 years old. My sister was 6 months. I remember that day vividly, the day that my dad left. And there's something to be said about fatherless daughters. And if you have daughters, I beg of you, dads who have daughters, you don't have to be married, or you just have to be present in your daughter's life, because there can be fathers living in the household who are not present in their daughter's lives, and I beg of you to be part of your daughter's life, more so than sons. They say that girls without fathers have a tendency to become alcoholic, have a tendency to be a little bit more promiscuous, and have a tendency to be addicts, you know, as well. And, you know, I fall into all three of those categories. And along the way, as I got older, my mother was raising two girls, and I grew up in Coronado, so no, I didn't have money. We were the poorest ones there. She just happened to be working on the base, and so we're fortunate enough to live, in some apartments there. But that's where I grew up, and it was a very sheltered life. By the time I was 12 years old, I was sexually abused by a family member. So all these things and these tragedies, this brokenness that I felt as a child growing up, alcohol suddenly became something that could do for me what I couldn't do for myself. It made me feel courageous. It made me feel prettier. It made me feel just so much better. It just numbed everything out. And I discovered alcohol at a very early age. My dad always thought it was really cute, to let a two-year-old, sip on beer. And so I've never had a problem with the taste of alcohol. I always really kind of liked it, And by the time I was about 13, or 14, I was, drinking, and I always just loved to drink. And I lived in this little I call it like a Mayberry RFD with a beach. It was kind of like what Coronado was like growing up. And, a lot of military, though. So a lot of my friends would come and go, but a lot of us, I always seemed to attract people that drank like me. And a lot of my friends drank like me. Well, here I am in chapter one of my life. This is chapter one, and it's the first 20 years of my life. As I got older and I was in high school, drinking just became a regular weekend thing. And I wasn't drinking alcoholically at this time, but I really liked alcohol. I really loved the effect produced by alcohol so much that I found other things to keep me awake so I could drink longer. And so, suddenly I started to get in trouble with that. I won't mention those other things. I think you probably know. I think most people in California have experimented with other things besides alcohol. But I will tell you this, because I have done the work as outlined in the big book, and I really know this first step, I will tell you this. I don't believe I'm an addict. I'm an alcoholic who's powerless over drugs is what I am. Whatever. Does it really matter whether I'm addict or alcoholic? I did a lot of dope. That's all I'm going to say. I did a lot. So I was living with my dope dealer when I was like 19. And by the way, I had my mom being very old-fashioned, girls weren't supposed to be doing, athletics and things like that, like the things that I wanted to do in high school. I was supposed to be in pageants, and I was supposed to know how to cook and be, a wife type person whatever. Anyway, so she wanted me to enter at pageants, and so I did, and I was Miss Coronado in 1981. That's what the year that I graduated from high school. You could do the math. I'll tell you right now, I'm 51 years old. All right. But when you win that title, there are certain things that you're not supposed to do, and especially if you're not 21, you're not supposed to be drinking, let alone I had this image to uphold in this city, and I wasn't upholding it very well. And and this is where all my troubles started. So after my reign was over, whew, thank God that was done, Jeez. These people are too serious about having to not drink, and not do anything else. My mom was a little sick and tired of it, and she figured that I needed to move and live with my dad. So off to Texas I went. So I moved from Coronado, California to Conroe, Texas. I felt like I had gone to prison because it was like there was nothing around where my dad lived. I mean, we were in the sticks. There was nothing out there. It took us like 20 minutes just to drive to the nearest 7-Eleven. It was like no friends, no nothing, But look, a good alcoholic like myself was able to find all the places and all the bars. And guess what? At that time, the legal drinking age in Texas was 19. I discovered that, and I was like off and running, right? And I was living with my dad at the time, and my mom not being alcoholic and my dad being alcoholic, I thought, well, this is going to be great. Now I'm going to have that dad in my life that I've always wanted for, that father-daughter relationship, and it didn't quite work that way. My dad at the time was married to about his fifth wife, One, two, three. Wait, Mary, Lynn. One, two. Yeah, that was wife number five. And I'm 19, right? And he's already been married five times. And so I'm like sick of them all. Except for I really liked Lynn a lot. And she was really cool. And she was a big part of my recovery the first time I got sober. So I'm living in Conroe, Texas, and, you know, and I found all the guys that drank whiskey and wore cowboy boots, and, you know, I hung out with those guys, you know, and every boyfriend I had, just so I want to let you know something, every single boyfriend I had had a shelf life of about 2 years. And that's about as long as I kept them. And I don't know why that was, you know, it was just like, honeymoon stage is over, and time to go. And you're not validating me anymore. I'm moving on. Not trying to work things out. And I was usually the dumper, you know, always dumping. So I had a boyfriend at this time, and, you know, he was getting a little sick of my, I met this guy in Houston, and he was getting a little sick of my drinking, and I was a little out of control. You know, I don't know why he was making such a big deal. I was just, you know, 19, 20 years old, just having a good time. And I remember one time I was, you know, and if anybody had a problem, he needed to watch my dad drink. My dad was the one with the problem. And I'll never forget when I was living with my dad, that relationship and living and under the same roof with my dad lasted about 9 months. I came downstairs one night when my dad was like completely loaded, and he was sitting next to my stepmother, and my dad's a Texan. He, of course, he's got guns, and it's just, you know, you live in Texas, you have guns. Like, you live in California on a surfboard. People just think that. He had guns everywhere, and he always taught us to shoot. You know, he taught me how to fish. I was like my dad's only son. So he taught me how to, you know, he always said, whatever you do, you never point a gun at someone. I don't care if the gun's not loaded. You never point a gun at somebody. And he was loaded. He was loaded, not the gun, he said. But he had the gun pointed at my stepmother's head. And Lynn was sitting there. She goes, Rolf, you know you taught us never to point guns, and I can hear the shakiness in her voice. He goes, it's not loaded, pulls the trigger at the wall and puts a hole in the wall. And at that moment, I go, I gotta move. So my dad is out of control. I don't drink like that. You know, I am not anywhere near as bad as he is. And that was pretty much how my whole life was. Always comparing my drinking with everybody else. Oh, I'm not that bad. So I'm okay. So I ended up getting in a car accident. Shortly after that, I moved out where I critically injured someone, and it was not a good scene. And my stepmother at the time had been going to Al-Anon, and she came up to me, and she noticed some similarities between my dad and I, although I didn't see them. And she said, you know, I really think that you might need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the time that I told you about this boyfriend that I had, he was agreeing with her, and I'm like, you know, and I didn't want to lose him, you know, so I decided to go. And she goes, you know, because I was doing other things as well, and she goes, don't go to NA because NA sucks, so you need to go to AA. Because, you know, she learned this in Al-Anon, that I needed to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I ended up going to both, and I got sober in November of 1983, and I stayed sober in the rooms of AA and NA for a while, but I didn't really have my first AA meeting until I moved to Fort Worth, Texas. And let me tell you something about, talk about revivals. These people were serious about recovery. I mean, you went into a room, first of all, you know, the meetings were, you know, you didn't share unless you had done this work, and, you know, nobody seemed to be bothered by it. That's just the way the meetings were. And, people were, you know, pumping that big book and talking about alcoholism, and even though I could relate to a lot of how they thought, how they drank, and how they felt, I was wanting to not put myself in that same category as them. Now, I stayed sober. I don't know how I did it. I just stayed dry for about a year, year and a half in that program. And I started to slowly, you know, slowly slip away from my friends, stop going to meetings. I remember going through the work, and I remember they told me, they go, you need to, you know, when I got into AA, they were like, do you have a sponsor? They bug me all the time. Do you have a sponsor? And I'm like, gosh, you guys are like really serious about this sponsorship stuff, you know. And I'm like, so they go, and you can't get a guy. And I'm like, oh, brother. So I found a woman who was a lesbian. And so attention is attention, right? And so she sponsored me for a while. And I'm not a lesbian, but I didn't care, because she really had the hots for me, and that's all that mattered, is she was validating me. And so that relationship, you know, with, you know, we became really good friends, and, you know, I just didn't feel like I related to you people. I didn't have any DUI. See, I was comparing myself with the things that had happened to you. When I was hearing the stories in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't hear the part about the physical, the mental obsession, the spiritual malady, you know, and that controlling my drinking. Someone asked me one time, have you ever tried to control your drinking? I'm like, why would I ever want to try to control my drinking? I'm 20 years old. I'm just always out of control when I drink. You know, can you help me with this here? And, you know, after a while, I really wanted to just really compare the differences, and I wanted to get myself out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I just didn't think I was like you guys. And so I did. And I'll never forget the first time I picked up a drink, and boy, I was off to the races, and this begins chapter two of my life. And chapter two, I like to call pages 20 through 21 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you know what those pages say, they talk about the three different types of drinkers. There's the moderate drinker, the hard drinker, and then the real alcoholic. And over the next 20 years, because I stayed in that. For the next 20 years, I was all three of those. And now, I don't know that I was ever really a moderate drinker, because I really surrounded myself around people who drank like me. So I would always, you know, like I said, I'm always comparing myself to how everybody else drinks. And boy, first of all, let me tell you, I had a belly full of AA. It was really hard going out there and drinking and trying to pull that out of your brain. I'm like, gosh darn it, they brainwashed me to make me think I'm this alcoholic, and I'm not. And I tried everything I could do to not drink alcoholically, so I hung out with people who drank like me. So that means I was living in Fort Worth at the time, and I was doing bikini contests in the Fort Worth stockyards in bars. I was hanging out in topless bars, and my friends were prostitutes and drug dealers, and so I just fit right in. You know, and that's kind of how, you know, and I was what they call a circuit girl. So I used to hit all the bikini contest circuits, and it's a really big deal back in the 80s, you know. And so it was, right? Okay, yeah, it was really big. They don't even do this anymore, so thank God, you know. But we used to hit all the, there's a group of us, but that's what we did. We'd go out to, you know, we'd start working at 5 o'clock at night, and we'd hit all these bars, and we would, you know, all win, you know, money, and, you know, it's just crazy. The money part of it wasn't the big deal. It was that I was able to drink like everybody else. I surrounded myself with people that drank just like me. What's the problem? There's no problem here. I don't have a problem. My friends had a problem. I didn't have a problem. And I managed to be that way for about 10 to 20 more years. And during that time, I started to see myself become a hard drinker. I met my husband in one of those bars. And this is my first husband. He had a shelf life too. He lasted 2 years. He was expired. Boom. I was 6 months pregnant with our son, and I was out the door. And literally, it was like, your time is up, and it's time for me to move on. I ended up getting a job working as a travel agent. And I went to school for it, and I suddenly now had this 9-to-5 job, and I no longer had any excuses to drink like I drank before. And I started to see how hard I was really drinking. And I started to see that I was able to control the amount that I drank once I drank, and there was never just having one drink. It was always drinking to oblivion. But I managed to do it at 5 o'clock every day after I got off of work, or 6 o'clock, or whatever. I managed to do that for a number of years. After I left my ex-husband, I moved back to California, had my son, lost my son in a messy custody battle, and it was a really sad time for me. And during that time, I had another boyfriend, you know, broke up with him after a year and a half. And then I met my husband that I'm currently married to now. And I thought, I got to be with this guy the rest of my life. I knew it from the day that I met him. And you know what? And he had fun friends. And his friends all drank like me. I had arrived. Thank God. This is exactly what I've been waiting for. And I mean, his friends partied like me, and we had a great time. And next thing you know, I got pregnant. And then I didn't drink through my pregnancy. I managed to stay completely sober during my pregnancy. I'm not an alcoholic. You know, only alcoholics would drink through their pregnancy. And so, you know, I'm doing just fine. And then we got married, and then I had this beautiful baby girl, and then got pregnant again a couple years later. We got married, got pregnant again a couple years later, had another baby, and just couldn't quite seem to not, I mean, drinking once a month was okay during pregnancy. Just a little, you know, glass of wine here and there. And so I did. Now, thank God my youngest daughter came out normal for the most part. She's a she's a little terror, let's just put it that way. She's a lot like her mother. So now I'm getting to the point now where I'm not functioning anymore. I stopped working at this 1-8 travel agency, and I drinking has become a necessity on a daily basis. And to make a long story short, I'm not going to go into a big, huge drunkalog, but drinking was not just daily, it was in the mornings. And I would wake up in the middle of the night, and I would stumble down the hall and try to find the bottle, and I would drink. Because it helped me overcome the shakes. And in the morning when I woke up again, I would have the sweats and shakes, and I'd walk down the hall and I'd put some vodka in my coffee and just choke it down and throw it up and choke it down until I could get it down, until that feeling left me. And there would be no, and then every single time I drank, I blacked out. And I would try, what the heck? What's this phenomenon? Why am I constantly blacking out more and more? And so I tried all these other ways to stop drinking. I tried Most Excellent Way, which wasn't so excellent. Lasted about 3 months. I managed to stay dry. And then I tried exercise, just like the book talks about. I tried drinking only wine. I tried switching. I tried everything the book talks about. And I hadn't even really read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous ever. You know, even when I was sober, when I was younger, I had no idea, you know, that what I was doing was exactly what, when I read this book for the first time, I'm like, that is me. I tried all these ways. And every time I'd get some time, I had an even worse relapse. What is with that? You know, it was like, why is it that every time I put a drink to my mouth, now I can't remember anything? And it got to where I started getting fearful, not for my life, but for my family's. Because I would wake up, and I'd wake up in different parts of the house. I'd be like, oh my God, how'd I get here? And then I used to keep this knife under my bed, and one time I couldn't find it, and I found it in my underwear drawer, and I'm like, when did I do that? I started to think, I'm going to kill somebody in the middle of the night in a blackout and not know that I did it. And on November 7th, 2005, after a series of attempts of trying to get sober, I told myself I am not going back to AA, because those people in AA back in Texas, they would come pick you up before a meeting. They'd put you in their car, and then they'd come and get you and make sure that you went. And I did not want to be held that accountable. I just needed to get a little bit of time. I just needed to clean up a little bit, and I knew AA was going to work, and I was scared to death of it. And on November 7th, 2005, I was picked up my daughters, who were 10 and 12 at the time, from soccer. And, you know, I'd been drinking, and I blacked out at the wheel and ended up in a ditch. And thank God I had someone else in the car with me, because they were able to drive me home. And I said, that's it. I go, all my attempts to try to stay sober, all my attempts to try to control my drinking, everything failed. And now I was fearful. Like my dad putting a gun to Lynn's head, that bullet went off. And next time that bullet was going to kill somebody. And I had turned into my father, and I had seen it, and I needed help. And for the first time in 20 years, I walked into my first AA meeting holding up my white flag going, all right, you guys got me. All right, and I sat in this meeting. Now we're in chapter 3. I like to call this chapter Not Drinking and Going to Meetings. So I went to this meeting, and I was sitting in this meeting. It was a women's meeting, and I'm not going to tell you where it was at, but I sat in this meeting, and I don't know what the topic was other than I remember this. And I'm going to share some things that might be a little uncomfortable, but I'm thinking some of you are going to really relate to me. And this woman was talking about her son and her job. And I'm like, and remember, I have like 24 hours sober and I'm sweating and shaking right now. And I'm like, what? And I remember sitting next to this lady and she was knitting. And I said, is this an AA meeting? And she goes, yes, honey, you'll be fine. Just sit here. And they went around the room and everybody shared. And then they called on me. And I'm like, wait a minute, I'm a newcomer. I mean, I'm not used to being able to share. We couldn't do this in Texas. And so they called on me and I shared. And I just said, look, I am like got like not even 24 hours and I'm dying here. And I don't know what I need to share, but I just need some help. And I will say this. After that meeting, these women came up to me and they loved me up and they gave me a big book. And one of them wrote her name and her phone number in it, and I went to that meeting every week. But you know what? I had just removed the alcohol. I had just removed the alcohol, and the big book talks about that. That's just scratching the surface. You know, and I knew that I needed to go through the work, so I found somebody who had like some time, and I figured, well, she'll be able to take me through the work. And so we went through the work. You know, one day we did step one, and then the next couple weeks later we did step two. And then I remember going through this, and I'd come to her house every single day, and I'd go to her house to do this, but each day was one step. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, pretty soon I'm going to be at 12, and then what? You know, and I wasn't having an experience. It was kind of like, you know, when you do homework, it's like you turn in all your homework and all of a sudden there's a test. It's like, you mean I was supposed to study that homework? You mean I'm supposed to know all this stuff? And it really was like a process for me. I just wanted to get a little bit of time. I didn't want an experience with this work. I needed to get a little bit of time because, see, by now, I had been married 12 years, and my husband's expiration date was way overdue. And I was sick of him and and everything about it. I was tired of it, you know. And I needed to get a little bit of time so I could get him out of my life, and I'll show him. I had a plan, you know. I had a plan, and I had big plans, right? Big plans. I was gonna get sober, and then I was gonna, you know, I didn't have to look in my rearview mirror anymore for the cops. Didn't have to worry about DUIs anymore. And that felt really good for a while. I could remember everything. I remember the shows I watched the night before. It was really, wow, it was just an awesome concept. I could go to church. I get to be like those ladies from Bible study now, you know? I was so excited to have this spiritual life. And I was really excited about that. But this husband was getting on my nerves. And by the way, my husband spent a lot of time drinking and keeping up with me. But he's not alcoholic. He's a really good Al-Anon. He's not an alcoholic, but he was a very good enabler. And there were, first of all, let me say something. Just because he drank like I did, given sufficient reason, he was able to stop or moderate. He used to piss me off, right? He could like, and still to this day, he can like drink a beer and then stop. Like one beer for a whole football game. And then he'll stop and then like drink water and then like be fine, you know, with that. He'll eat everything on his plate and eat my food, but leave a half a glass of wine. It's cunning, baffling, and powerful to me. I don't understand it. Even to this day, even with almost 9 years sober, I can't believe that he does this. But you know, when I first met him, remember I was telling you that his friends used to drink like me, and he would keep right up, but he was always responsible. I gotta go to bed, gotta get up in the morning. You know, it's like, oh, annoying. You know, and other things. I was in a meeting the other day and I heard someone say, well, if you think you're alcoholic, you might be. You probably are. That's not what the book tells us and this program tells us. And look, my husband thought he was alcoholic, keeping up with me for many years. And he's able to stop or moderate given sufficient reason. Me, given sufficient reason, never able to quit. Ominous warnings I failed to heed, right? Frothy emotional appeal from my family and friends, my children begging me to quit was never enough. Never enough. For years that went on. And never enough. So here I am sober. So my sober thinking now that I don't have alcohol on my brain anymore, all my sober thoughts must be, you know, I must be right about everything that I think. because, you know, I'm not drinking and I'm going to meetings. And that's what I am, because I'm a meeting maker and I'm going to make it because that's what I'm told. And let me tell you something right now. If you're going to meetings and not drinking, you are not in recovery. I hate to break it to you. It's what you're doing in those meetings and what you're doing outside those meetings. Are you balanced in that circle and triangle? And take it from me. And the reason why I'm saying this is because I was living in this spiritual malady for the first 4 years of my recovery and seriously feeling like I was going to die. I seriously felt this depression that came over me that made me feel suicidal at 4 years sober. I moved out, left that husband, you know, and left my kids, abandoned my kids, got my own apartment, thought that I needed something external to fill this internal condition because that's always what I knew, right? Guys, you had a shelf life, and if you weren't valid, if this one wasn't validating me, I was going to find someone to validate me, and I'm going to be totally honest with you. I'm going to be totally honest with you. This was what I did to make me feel okay. You had to make me feel okay. And if you weren't making me feel okay, I was going to find somebody else. And that's why I was going to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So whoever it was at the time, whoever was my victim, was going to make me feel okay. I left my husband, left my kids, lived in this apartment, was sitting there after seeing a therapist because I was going through this major depression, trying to figure out how I was going to kill myself. And I didn't know how I was going to do it. I thought about maybe jumping out of a car. I thought about going to the Coronado Bridge and jumping off the bridge. My therapist had called me. She was like giving me suicide hotlines. She didn't know how to get to me. And I remember that night I went to Alpine to go watch my kids. It was December of 2009. And I went to go watch my kids ice skating. And someone told me I needed to come to this meeting, this SoCal speaker meeting. And I'm like, you know, I just don't think so. I'm all the way in Alpine, and something possessed me. And I swear to this day it was God. And he got me in my car, and I came here. And I heard this woman speak. And if you haven't heard Tyla speak, she's spoken. I challenge you all to go online tonight. She spoke December 2009. And you can listen to what the message that I heard. And what I heard was a woman who had 13 years sober, who was dying inside and wanted to kill herself. And she was telling my story. And I thought, I heard a message with a solution that I didn't have to live like this anymore. I heard a message that came across that I know God was speaking through her. She was an empty vessel, and she was God's voice that night, and she was talking to me. And she was probably talking to a lot of other people, too. But she was talking to me that night. And it has ever changed my life since. And I remember after the meeting, I went up to her, and there was this huge line to talk to her. I go, I don't care. I'm going to wait. And I'm like, what meetings do you go to? So I found out what meetings she went to, and I really did stalk her. I'm just like checking her out and listening to her and going to these meetings. And finally I asked her one day if she would sponsor me. She goes like, oh, I'm really busy. And she goes, well, you're like a Christian, aren't you? And I go, well, yeah. She goes, well, I'm bi. And I'm like, that's never stopped me before. I didn't say that, but I'm like, bring it on. But I didn't care if she was a monkey's uncle. I wanted what she had. I wanted what this woman had. This woman was powerful. I'd never heard anything like this, and I knew she was busy. I knew she sponsored a lot of women, and I knew she sponsored a lot of women outside of San Diego, Israel, Australia, England. I'm like, she's just not going to have time for me. But I told her I was going to stalk her, and so she thought that was funny, and she ended up sponsoring me. And so now I enter the last and final chapter of my life, chapter 4. And I don't really have a title for this. I don't know why I came up with this in meditation, but it just was something that just seemed clear to me. I heard this woman speak, and she showed me that this was a selfless program. This is not a selfish program. It would be selfish if only I was getting something out of it. But yes, I do get something out of it when I work with another alcoholic, and so does that other person. And it would be selfless if only I got something out of it and I charged you. Then I could fire you and hire you. I don't do that. Neither does she. There is no hiring or firing. I don't get paid for doing this. I don't get paid for taking people through the work. It is God's will that I do this. This is a selfless program. It is not selfish. and she showed me selflessness like I've never seen before. You know, she told me to call her, and then if I told her I was going to call her at 2 o'clock, 2:15 rolled around, she'd be calling me, how come they didn't call me? You know, I'm like, oh, wow, this is a busy woman, right? She's calling me, how come they didn't call me? And she showed me, thank you, she showed me that the first step of this, that she asked me if I'd ever gone through the steps, and I said I had, and she said, no, I hadn't. Have you ever done a real first step? And the first step of Alcoholics Anonymous, step one, is not on the wall. It's not, because that's how I did it. Yeah, I'm powerless over alcohol. My life is unmanageable. I thought the unmanageable part of my life was all the stuff I did when I was drinking. You know, gosh, I was unmanageable when I drank. You know, like when I first got sober, I just was out of control when I drank, you know. And the unmanageability of this is not, and the insanity of this is not what happened to me after I picked up. That was drunkenness. That despite what happened to me, despite the consequences, despite all the horrible things that happened to me after I picked up, stone cold sober, I made the decision to drink again, thinking either it was going to be different or not caring, but just drinking again. That would be like having a peanut allergy and your throat closing up and just going, I've got to eat peanuts. See, there's no mental obsession attached to peanut allergies. But there is with, and there's a spiritual malady and a mental obsession in addition to the physical allergy attached to alcoholism. Do you know alcoholism is the only medical condition that has a spiritual remedy? And it's the only medical condition where you diagnose yourself. Do not let anybody tell you you're alcoholic. You need to find out your own truth. Nobody knows how you think, drink, and feel except for you and God. And only you can answer that. Only you know what happens to you once you put a drink into your mouth. Only you know that. And until you can be entirely honest, then you can diagnose yourself. But it takes some honesty. And you have to be able, and if you think you make your own diagnosis, don't you think you better know? I needed to know what alcoholism was. And it's in the first, out of the first 103 pages, which were the steps, and this my wonderful sponsor showed me that I had no idea the steps were in the big book. I had no idea. I'm like, really? I thought it was, that's the 12 and 12, you know? I thought that's where the steps were. I had no idea the first 52 pages of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous was the first step. That must be pretty important. I have to get step one right. I got to be 100% certain that I'm the real alcoholic. I can't have any doubt. The idea that I'm like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. Presently maybe. Me at 5 years, me at 20 years, me at 50 years sober. That idea has to be smashed. I always figured if I get a little bit of time, maybe I might be able to drink like others. Right? There's that story in the big book about I call him Mr. Carpet Slippers, you know? 25 years, dry, bone dry, and he dies. Right? This disease is powerful. This disease is no joke. It is a medical condition. I have a physical allergy. When I put alcohol into my body, I break out into craving. I have a mental obsession, I have a mind that's going to take me back to a drink. Every single time, unless the spiritual malady is overcome, then I straighten up mentally and physically. Every day is a day that I got to read, and not read 84 through 88. I got to do 84 through 88. I have to be in step 10. I had no idea step 10. This is embarrassing. I was pissed, you know. I was really pissed this is 5 years ago, and I'm like, what the hell? How come nobody's ever told me this before? Look, this is just my story. I hope none of you have had the experience that I had the first time from my first 4 years of being sober. But I feel like my sobriety date started 5 years ago when I started to do this work, because I started to have an experience with the steps. I started to have an experience. I took this big book and I changed statements into questions, because I can't have a spiritual experience based on a statement. And when I see that word we, I think it's talking about you. And I had to change the we's to I's, and I had to ask myself, does this apply to me? Do I feel that way? Do I believe this? And then I can answer yes. And I thought for sure I wasn't agnostic. That chapter was for all of you who didn't believe in God. But I could see my present day agnosticism. That belief in a God which I had wasn't enough. See, because I gave God just my alcoholism. God, I'm going to run my life, right? I'll do this relationship thing on my own. I got it. You can just have my one egg. I'm not giving you all my eggs. Just my one alcoholism. You know, there's just that you can just take from me. Every area of my life That's what this book is about. I thought that this book was a book on how to stay sober. Do you know that it's not? It tells us on page 45, the second paragraph on page 45, it said, well, that's what this book is about. Its main object is to help you find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problems. Not keep you sober, all my problems. See, my problems are deep down within me. If I'm just going to remove the alcohol, that's only scratching the surface, is what the book said. I can see that now. It'd be like having a tree with dead leaves, just cutting off the leaves. Well, let's find out what's making those leaves dead. It goes down deep into the root. And I didn't see that until I got to this inventory. And I'd never done an inventory like this. This inventory was crazy. This inventory showed me that I was driven by 100 forms of fear, delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. I step on the toes of my fellows and they retaliate. And I wonder why. You know, and every single resentment that I had was fueled by fear. Some underlying fear that fueled my resentment. These fears that kept me from succeeding in life. These fears that kept me from speaking in life. These fears that kept me from doing anything in my life. You know, and I had to ask God to be rid of those. Not my character defects are my fears. But not all my fears. There are some healthy fears to have. And I had to ask God in 6 and 7 to please remove the ones that are blocking me from you. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to gain a spiritual connection with God. That's not why I came here. That's why I went to church. I never got it in church like I got it in Alcoholics Anonymous. My relationship with God grew stronger and deeper than it ever had before. And I didn't come here for that. I came here because I couldn't quit drinking. I came here because I didn't know how to stay stopped. And staying stopped is not just removing the alcohol, it's going deep within. These fears kept me from being able to make a living. And there's these things called the bedevilments. Did you know that there's bedevilments in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? I didn't. Page 52 talks about being unable to be of real help to anyone. Full of fear. Thank you. My mind just went whoosh. I was like having this outer body experience. These bedevilments on page 52, I was living in them stone cold sober. Stone cold sober. After 4 years of being sober, that's where I was. I was a walking bedevilment, was what I was. We can laugh about it now, right, Rick? But seriously, alcoholism isn't about how many DUIs you got. And if you're sitting in the rooms tonight and you never got a DUI, you never got in trouble with the law, you never had, you know, all these external problems, doesn't mean that you're not alcoholic. You don't have to have those happen in your life. Those of us that got that were just unlucky drunks. We just got busted, all right? But how many times should you have gotten busted? How many times should you have gotten a DUI? It's not that you got a DUI that makes you an alcoholic. And you could have gotten a couple DUIs and still not be an alcoholic. But I can't determine that. Only you can determine that for yourself. And you can't diagnose anybody else either. They have to do that. But hopefully you have good sponsorship, like the sponsorship that I was shown and in my home group and the rooms that I go to, where we show people, you know, I don't want you to have my experience. I want you to have your own spiritual experience. I am excited today to take people through the work. You know, step 12 says nothing so much can ensure immunity as to work with another alcoholic. Ensure immunity. By the way, I am a recovered alcoholic today. You know the word recovered is mentioned about 20 times in the first 103 pages. I'm not cured of alcoholism. I can't just go drink casually. You know, I'm like in remission, right? I just don't metabolize alcohol the same way as a normal person does, right? And I never will. But I'm recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. That's what I'm recovered from. The big book talks about it in step 10. I recoil from alcohol as if from a hot flame. Those 10-step promises, I feel those every single day. And it's because I have, if I don't work on my spiritual life on a daily basis, I do my, every single day is a day that I gotta give God His glory and I gotta ask God into my life. Every single day I have to ask God, you know what, not just remove not just keep me sober today, God, let me, I waive my right for free will, right? You work in me and you do with me what you want. This is not about a Leanne show anymore. I don't run the show. You know, this isn't my ballet and you have to be a certain way for me to be okay. I could be okay with me today because I did this thorough inventory. I asked God to remove those fears. My husband doesn't have to behave the way I think he's supposed to be okay for me to still. I have gone through this work and it has changed my life tremendously. I work with other alcoholics and I'm excited. I'm excited to work with other women today. You know, I wasn't before. I didn't have anything else to give them. Today I have a message of depth and weight. No middle of the road solution. I don't know about you as an alcoholic, but this alcoholic needs to have a message and a solution that has depth and weight. And that's what I found by going through this work. And I gotta have this solid foundation with God in my life. He is the cornerstone and the keystone. He is the source that keeps me sober today. And whatever your idea of God is your idea of God. It's not, my idea may be different from yours, it doesn't matter. But it says there is one who has all power. That one is God. We all worship one God, we just see him in different ways. We're all his kids. You know, I look at my dad a different way than my sister looks at my dad, but we still have one dad. Whatever your idea of God is your idea of God. And however you view him is your view of God. But my relationship with God is way more powerful, way stronger than it ever was before. And I thank him every single day for the people in my life that I love, that have shown me this direction. And I thank God for Tyler Colton, my sponsor, who has, I don't know, I think she's an angel. But sometimes she could be a little, but I love, she's a hard ass too when she needs to be one, and I love her, and thank God for you. I thank the Rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love SoCal Speaker Meeting. Thank you so much.